Do it.
Okay. I think that's the beginning. That's how we're starting.
Yeah, that tracks. Mm-hmm.
Don't turn off this podcast. This is what you think it is. If you're looking for Hopnology or False Bottom Girls, you found them both. So this is very exciting. We are recording together on a beautiful Sunday morning. And this is Greg. I've got James, Jen, and Rachel, and we are all here.
It's like the crossover episode between Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley.
It is.
Right? How cool is that, right?
Mm-hmm. And we will get this out on the Hopnology YouTube channel, so you will be able to see all of us together here, drinking our coffee. It's morning, so we're behaving ourselves. Well, I promise this is coffee. That's,
yeah.
Yes.
You know.
We have to make that promise?
Also coffee.
Okay.
Not promising.
Nope. Promise, not promise.
So I guess we'll start for those of you. Thank you for joining us. This is going to be a lot of fun. We are excited to get to know you. I'll tell the story I told a few minutes ago, which is that I found you guys on Instagram through our friend Asa, who does the Beer Paired Life Instagram. And I listened to a couple of your episodes, and I texted James and said, "You got to listen to these two. It's like us, just like us." And so we've started listening to you. I know you started listening to us, and we've been talking for a while about getting together here because we have, I think, similar viewpoints on a lot of things in the brewing industry. But you're coming at it from a brewing perspective. We're coming at it from a growing perspective. And the merger can only be more than the sum of its parts.
Right.
So for your audience, James and I are Hopnology. We, for 10, 12, 87 years, had hop
something
fields,
like that.
Something
yep.
like that. Mm-hmm. We grew hops out in central Wisconsin. We now, that was called Gorse Valley Hops. We are now Hopnology, and we do consulting and online resources and things like that for small scale hop growers. And right. As well as for brewing formulation and things like that. We just right. love the industry. We love beer. And we have our own podcast. We are coming up on 100 episodes, so we're super excited
wow.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
And James, anything you want to add to?
I do, aside from the techie plant physiologist scientist guy, I'm also a sensory scientist and an aroma scientist. So I teach at Siebel Institute in Chicago. And particularly around hop chemistry and aroma chemistry in beer from hops. Hop extracts, advanced hop products, as we say. So all things hops, and gives me a great soapbox upon which to complain about the state of beer. So,
and I'm a professional beer drinker, so that's right. where I come into the mix here.
Excellent.
So Jen and Rachel?
Yeah, well, thank you guys also for reaching out. And, you know, a funny story. So Asa is definitely... touched several parts of my life, but she and I met in Charlotte in 2000, I believe 17, when we were both taking the advanced Cicerone exam. We sat next to each other. And since then, you know, we have several people. So if you're listening, Asa, thank you very much for connecting us here. But mm-hmm. then also we've had, you know, several people that she's very talented at bringing the community together in interesting ways. But yes, so for everyone listening who is not familiar with us, we are False Bottom Girls. And this is, Rachel and I started this podcast, I guess a little over a year and yeah. maybe like a year and a half or so ago. We actually started way, way back in the beginning of 2019 talking about the idea and finally decided, you know what, we're just going to go for it. And recorded a few episodes, thought we recorded a few episodes, and it turns out we did not.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. yeah. Yep. kind of trial and error. And, you know, finally, and I know that you guys can attest to this, the actual putting it out there is probably one of the most difficult steps of, you know, this is something we've been talking about, something we're passionate about, and then putting it out there for the public consumption was really kind of scary, but we did that in August of 2019. So our podcast, the different episodes really vary on what the topics are. So Rachel and I are both advanced Cicerones. We're both studying for the Master Cicerone exam. If not for, you know, gesturing to the world around us, we would have sat for the Master Cicerone exam this past October. So a lot of our topics come out of the two of us studying for the Master Cicerone exam and picking out, a lot of times picking out topics that we don't actually feel particularly strong about, because learning to communicate those concepts to people is one of the best ways to learn. So I know I'm definitely excited to be with you guys today. Before I joined New Realm, I was actually in the malt side of the business, specifically craft malt. So a lot of talking about flavor, a lot of talking about how, you know, craft malt is so much different from, you know, basically the malt that everybody has been used to using really until the last 10 years ago or so. So I think this is a really interesting synergy to have, you know, kind of us together. We can almost make like a really interesting beer together. We just need some yeast people and some water people on this podcast, and we'll have all of our expertise.
I think we could find them. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So yeah, and then I'll let Rachel kind of introduce herself and her side of the podcast.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Rachel. I have been brewing since about 2011, but I kind of started in the beer world on the serving side, as serving in beer bars, if you will, specifically Capitol House in Richmond, Virginia, where I'm from, just a huge amount of beer selection. So I learned very much about serving, drinking beer before I learned about brewing it. Started for a brewery in Richmond called Hardywood Park Craft Brewing in 2011. They taught me how to brew. They had hired one person to work there, and it was a huge amount of work. So I got kind of lucky in the sense of being available and learning, you know, how to clean kegs and do the dirty work and start from the bottom. And it was great. And so I spent about 2.5 years there, went out to Colorado to work for Left Hand Brewing for about a year. My husband now, he was commuting back and forth for work. He's a pilot. So when we got the chance for him to be here, to live here and work here, we chose to move to Charlotte, or say here, to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I worked for Noda Brewing Company for a while, while we opened up our small little nano brewery, Pilot Brewing Company, play on his job and our small batch brewing style. Mm-hmm. So, you know, long, long story short, that is me in a nutshell. We've been open for 2.5 years now, almost, and we just love making small batch, specialized, whatever we want. We really don't do the flagship thing that much. We kind of have a couple beers here and there we keep, but we just like to keep it real, keep it small, do what we want. We brew within traditional styles and try to keep a nice range on, and we like to brew to enter competition specifically, because that's one of our fun things we like to do is enter mm-hmm. competition. So we brew styles to win.
Cool.
And yeah, we just have fun. Right now we have like, what do we have? 12, 16 draft lines, bunch of cans. Because of the virus, we started canning. So we pump out small little batches. We do about like 300 barrels a year right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I definitely brewed more beer in one day at Left Hand.
Yeah.
But I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way. I hate working for the big guy. I hate doing the big thing, the production side, even though we do it now a little bit. But it's fun to just kind of have creative control. So that's what our brewery is all about. And then I get to do fun things like this podcast.
Nice.
Yes. So here we are.
Very cool.
Well, thrilled.
You know, that since you brought it up about different styles and small batch, you know, one of the things that I had wanted to ask, and one of the things James and I have talked about a lot, is our styles in the industry and IPA bombs being all the rage for what feels like forever now. And neither one of us are huge fans of those. And the word you hear us talk about a lot is balanced. If it's a balanced IPA is great. Most of them are not. Most of them are, you know, the more you can, hops can cover lots of bad brewing practices if you throw enough of them in there. So for both of you, from your respective breweries, how do you balance brewing what you want to brew? And both of you studying for Cicerone, I mean, you know all the styles that are out there. You've got your favorites, but I imagine you also respect the styles that you don't enjoy from the craft perspective. But how do you run a business and cater to today's tastes, which I'll say are unbalanced, but still do what you love?
Right. I mean, I have a fairly short answer to this because, as Rachel puts it, I'm on the desk side of the brewery. So I'm usually, if I'm in the brew house, they know it's because I have like some weird request, or I'm very fortunate to have an extremely knowledgeable brewing staff who is also extremely indulgent when I just randomly send them Teams messages to be like, do we do a ferulic acid rest on our Hefeweizen? Why or why not? You know, they're very tolerant of that. But for me, I do that. I answer that from the home brewing side. So for instance, yesterday I brewed an American Porter. This upcoming weekend, I'm going to brew a Grodzicki, because if you know anything about me, you know how much I love smoked beers. And that's really where I'm able to find my curiosity for different styles. And studying for master, having that homebrew scale system has been fantastic, because I might not particularly like a Scottish export, let's say, but I can brew 5 gallons of it, and I can learn through that experience a little bit more about that style and appreciation for that style.
I am going to send you a self-addressed box, because those are the Porter and the Grodzicki, those are two of my favorites. So
excellent.
I'm going to send you a box with my address on it. And
samples, yes, for sensory analysis.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. Right. I would love to do that. And actually, a really cool thing about this Porter that I made yesterday is Sugar Creek Malt Company in Indiana. I also talk about them all the time because they are really leading the charge in terms of innovation for craft brewing with craft malt, but they sent me a few pounds of bourbon barrel aged chocolate malt. And so that is what I used in my American Porter yesterday. And the spent grain smell amazing. The mash smelled amazing. I don't think you're going to taste it and say, is this barrel aged? But it's going to add that kind of complexity to it in the background. Mm-hmm. But I digress. I'm just very excited about that beer. Nice. Like Rachel said, when I was looking for a career in the beer industry, I didn't want, brewing never appealed to me because I didn't want to be a production brewer. And I know of plenty of brewers who do have flagships or do have beers where their most popular beer is not the one that they like. You know, it's not their favorite. It's not their favorite style, but they're brewing it for that customer demand, which is also why when Rachel had approached me about working at Pilot when they were first opening, I jumped at the chance because they, and I will let her take over in just a second, but that opportunity to just brew what you want. And as she says, she has very much an educational brewery for the employees and for guests. So saying, I would like to brew this, and then kind of figuring out how to make that work was something for me with a nano brewery like Pilot, was a fantastic way of just being able to brew the beers that you like, not brewing the beers that the market dictates, which is kind of where New Realm is. And just in terms of scale and production, is very much in, you know, both of the states where we're distributed, you have to have a distributor. So it's more of like a demand pulling supply rather than supply pushing demand.
Right.
Yeah. I would say it's totally opposite for me. Because like you said, New Realm's got so much beer. They have to sell it. Like, you can't just go, you know, make 500, 600 barrels of, you know, a Lichtenhainer. I mean, it's going to take a while.
Oh my God, I wish we could.
No, but for me, it's so great because, I mean, if you've listened to any of my podcasts, you know I hate the New England's. You know I hate milkshake. Like, anything gimmicky, I'm not going to do. I'm just not going to do it. I don't like it. There's no reason to. I also am making super small amount of beer. Like, my biggest batch is 6 barrels. But I don't need to. Like, when there's so many breweries around me that are, like, I especially don't need to. We thrive on Cicerone. I say thrive because I very much instill it into our team. I get them to that second level. I encourage them to go further. You know, I give them the tools they need to get there, which, you know, that is a BJCP style guideline focused test. So those are the styles we brew to. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, we enter all the competitions. When I say we brew to those styles, other competitions have the same styles. They just have different styles. So we're just like, if I tell them to go study, I tell them to go study that. But we just like, if we brew an ESB, you're going to get an ESB. It's not going to be this weird take on ESP, which I've had people like that I've even interviewed being like, I like to do weird things and like make, you know, really weird red ales, like not just a red ale, but like all these things. And I'm like, you know what? I don't have time for that. I don't have time to teach you why that's not like, or to undo all these habits. Like for me, it's just, you don't need, and when like going back to New England IPA specifically, because I know this is just like what everyone loves.
No.
I know you guys don't, but no. Yeah, I say if you're like 28 or younger, right, into craft beer, you probably like these things. Perfect example of why we don't drink beers. I have two really great stories. Well, or examples. One, we make Southeastern IPA. It is a style that I did not come up with this. Like, actually, I heard about it because Noda Brewery made the first one that I heard of, which is fine. But like, this is a kind of a newer IPA style. All it is just brewed with like the use of corn or grits. It's still got a low bitterness, high hop flavor, high hop aroma, like a New England, but it's clear and it doesn't have the hop burn and it's not overly hopped. And people who love New England IPAs love this beer. They love this style. They don't understand what they like. They're just being told the hazier the better. And I'm like, that's not true. And this is why. And then you talk about the hop burn and they're like, oh yeah. And I hear about it from buyers all the time too. Like they're so over the New England IPA. Like they love it when I just have like this clear. And I tell them, like, people, if you know anything about Rachel or Pilot Brewing in Charlotte Beer World, you know that they don't do New England's. I make it very clear. My Southeastern IPA right now is called Snowbird, and it has like a plane going from New England to like Florida. It's like very obvious that I hate the style. And so, but people love it. Like nobody comes to, they don't, no one's like, oh, let's go to Pilot. Let's not go to Pilot because they don't have a New England. People don't say that. But it works for me because I don't have a crap ton of beer. I don't need to appeal to the bro market of the Haze Bros New England IPA. And if you, on a flip side, we do contract brewing, so I can do it. I just choose not to do it.
Greg, don't we have an episode called A Little Dead on the Inside? Yes. Rachel said, did you die a little bit on the inside every time you have to do that?
I think that one's actually about hop cone growth.
Okay. Oh, okay, all right.
but it does resonate with how you feel sometimes looking at these beer lists.
Right.
But I don't need to do those styles. And right. My brewery is a perfect example of them. Of not needing to do it. We've never done it. We don't do, like, I don't mind if you make a stout with some vanilla beans and cocoa nibs and toasted coconut, but you don't need to throw pies and donuts into it. And that's the limit, you know?
It's just like, quick don't get batter mix.
Get these ingredients, get these flavors from somewhere else. And I think people really appreciate that. We also are really transparent in everything we do with like the community. We do a lot of community focused like brews, like involved like the homebrew club. We brew the homebrew club winners beers, mm-hmm. You know, so like people know if you want something, if you want to have like an option, we have new beers all the time. So they can rely on that. They like that. They can rely on the fact that I'm going to not have the New England IPA if they're like me and don't like that stuff. If I release an ESB, people know it's going to be a classic ESB, you know, and or brown ale, and they get excited. Like Jen made me, because she made me brew a brown ale for, we're doing this promotion called the Brewer's Days of Christmas. We released 12 beers in 12 days. Mm-hmm. Today's like number 10 or something. And I did a brown ale. So I was like, Jen, I don't know what to brew and I have Cali ale. Like, how about a brown ale? It's like, oh, so boring. She's like, but it's not because no one brews it. I was like, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was like if I walked into any brewery and saw just an American brown ale that just said American brown ale, I would be so excited.
That's one of my favorite breweries here. I talk about them all the time, the vintage. They have one called Butternut Road, and it's a straight up American brown ale. And man, it hits the spot because, you don't see them.
It works. People love it.
Yep.
And especially buyers. Like, it's so funny because I will distribute so much German Hefeweizen, so much ESB, so much brown ale, and not really that much IPA. Because there's so many IPA options, but there's none of these others.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So when I make beers like that, they just fly.
Yeah, so I'm gasping for a quality ESB. I can't get one.
I can. I have one place out here that makes a very nice ESB, and I'm always showing it to James on camera and teasing him. I can get
followers. So we're also not profitable yet, so take that with what you will.
Mm-hmm. Hey, that's never stopped Greg or myself. No, ever.
No. F the man, but, you know, still in the red.
Yeah. So from a taproom perspective, and, you know, we have a couple of stereotypical characters on our show. One of them, his name is John. He's behind the bar, and we always say, don't be John. John's the one who sits there behind the bar and talks about how smart he is about beer to people who don't know what to drink. So you've got folks come into your tap room, you've got an ESB and a brown, and you don't have the standards. What do you do with that consumer who's looking at your servers going, well, you know, I'm only into double IPAs. The more alcohol, the better. What do you got for me? Sure. How do you convince them that a brown ale is worth their time?
Well, we typically do have a good range. We can find something you want. If you have that person who, you either have a person who's willing to try something or not. Like if they're in there for the New England IPA, like I had a Hefeweizen on draft and I named it Hazy Skies Hefeweizen on purpose. And when we ran out, I had a guy come in looking for that New England IPA specifically. And I made him like stumble through his words. I was like, what do you mean? Like, he's like, you know, the hazy. I was like,
that's
hey,
awesome.
We have another wheat beer. We have a wheat beer. You want to try that? And he's like, try it. He's like, I don't like this. He loved the Southeastern. I'm like, and then I finally like gave in and like told him, you know, it was a wheat beer, but you don't like,
people are
don't
awful.
Know what they
They're
like.
Awful. They're just, I hate them all.
I've been dealing with people who like the beer customer since I was 19, because when you worked at this beer bar, they taught you like, okay, you're going to have customers who are the guy who comes in and he knows everything about beer and he knows what he wants. Just whatever, just give him what you want. But then you have people who are like, okay, I want the highest thing in alcohol. Well, at our brewery, that's going to be a stout right now, or this like Saison I have, and they might like either of those, but normally those people don't really come into like the craft brewery tap room that closes at 9 p.m. You don't really get it that much.
Right.
So typically those people, you just give them the highest alcohol, or you figure out what they really actually like. And it's normally like a light lager, but, you can, if people want some advice, they're very easy to guide. Like, we have a beer for everybody, whether you're a wine drinker or you only like mimosas or you only like coffee normally, like we can guide you. And I mean, through anything really, as long as you're open to being guided. If you come in with that attitude of, well, I only like IPAs and I'm only going to drink New England. Well, I mean, all I can do is give you a sample and explain to you why this is better in my opinion. But I mean, most people are there for the experience. Like you don't really have, like, there are breweries that do have those people. Like we are in a neighborhood that is kind of low key, a little bit older of a crowd. Like if you go to the south end of Charlotte, it is very bro-y, and you do get like, oh, I just want the hazy. Yeah, the highest alcohol. So those people are out there. You can only do what you do. Like when you have someone asking for something like that, they don't have that much knowledge to really understand what your offerings are anyways.
They're drinking what they're being told to drink by.
Yeah, they're just like,
their market influences.
Where's the hazy? This beer I had last week had the word hazy next to it. Like literally this guy is drinking freaking Hefeweizen for probably 2 months thinking he was drinking a New England IPA. Mm-hmm. And I did it on purpose, knowing people would order that beer, not even realizing. Oh,
Rachel, I knew I liked you just from your podcast. I like you even more now. Because that's a straight up James move right there. So that's
yeah. Well, we have at specifically in Atlanta, I have a John, and I have spent most of my career actively fighting against Johns as employees and as customers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a big part of my role with New Realm is like the majority of my role is education, and that's also educating our staff. And for me, you know, having been like looked over or talked down to enough in the brewing world, when I go up to the bar, when arguably I know more more than likely, I know more than the person behind the bar. You know, speaking to somebody respectfully and going through that exercise of helping them find something that they like is very, very important to me. So from my perspective, to insure against John's is making sure that the staff has the education and the confidence that they need. So if somebody comes in and says, I usually only like hazies, or I'm not really sure what I like, normally I drink cider or seltzer or whatever, that they can then ask those kinds of leading questions and create, you know, an educational environment for the customer as well. Because I've talked with plenty of people who will tell you that their favorite beer is, you know, some special release from Sierra Nevada 3 years ago, but it's specifically because they went into a bar not knowing anything about beer. The bartender spoke to them and gave them several different beers to try. And that was the one that they really liked. And they will tell you, that's one of my favorite beers. And, you know, and, oh, I always look for it and I can't find it. But it's one of the reasons why it's their favorite is because somebody took the time to teach them about the beer and to help them go through the process of figuring out what it is that they like.
Yeah, very true. That's why we're so, like, our people that work at Pilot, they brew and bartend. They do both. Like, they do everything. So there's not many people, so it's easy. But there's three. But they spend their time brewing and they spend their time bartending. So it was very much intentional because I hate it going into breweries and the person working behind the bar doesn't even know how big the system is. Doesn't know, like, the basic questions. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was just so tacky and I did not want that. So, they want to brew and they love it and they get to do what literally whatever they want a lot of the times when it comes to brewing. So there's a lot of ownership back there for them. So they're equally as proud as the beer serving as I am. I think a lot of times I'm also kind of so intimidating. Like, I got my boots on and I'm like, brewery work. And I'm like, people are, if I happen to open the bar, which I do sometimes, I'm like, okay, what do you want? You know,
come on, make with it. Come on.
I'll help you. It is not, I'm helpful, but no one tries to give me bullshit. And, Amanda will tell me stories of people or Casey too. I'm like, man, why don't I ever get that? Why do I always miss the good stuff? You know, I always miss it. How come this never happens to me? I don't think I don't give anyone time to
I'm used to that. I know exactly what you're talking about.
See, I'm that annoying consumer who will get in between another consumer and the bartender and say, no, I know what I know. I can just tell. I know what he's going to like. Yeah. I'm the Greg, I guess.
The uninvited opinion.
The uninvited opinion. That is me.
Have time, I'll be the first person to take someone behind the bar back into the brewery because it's like right there. It's so easy. Mm-hmm. And I love doing that. If they're worth it.
Yep.
John.
Yeah, you don't want a John. No.
I don't want a John.
No, you don't need to feed that ego.
Yeah, and if you're listening and you wonder if you're a John, then you probably are, so stop.
Yeah, just stop.
Put the podcast off now.
Yeah. Very true. Very, very true. All right, let's talk some hops.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
I definitely know just like everything, like how did it start it? Why did you do it? Why don't you do it now?
History? Right? No, we don't have a farm anymore.
Yeah.
Why did we do it? I started it. Long story short. I did agricultural field research all over the world for years and years. And I saw these other cropping communities in other countries, mostly in Central and South America, that were growing specialty crops, melons, berries, cacao, coffee, whatever happens to be, as communities. And they had certain members in the community that would take and basically broker the relationship between the grower and the buyer, in many cases a large like Dole or Del Monte or somebody like that, right? And they would broker the whole relationship. They would go and understand what the quality demands were, understand what the market forces were, look at contracts, come back, communicate that to the people who are actually doing the production. And then they would do a value share. So nobody, you know, that in that go-between, let's call it the middleman, didn't take a cut until after everything was sold. And then they shared in the value of whatever was created as a percentage. So they were highly incentivized to get the people who were doing the growing to produce the highest quality, the most, you know, just whatever the top end of that market would allow, because they were going to get a bigger cut if they did that. I said, I want to do that at home because our agricultural system is broken. But I needed a crop to do it on. And I didn't want to reinvent the wheel, right? I didn't want to have to build a market from scratch for something nobody wants, like aronia berries or something like that, right? So what do I have baked in to Wisconsin that I don't have to do anything for?
Drunk people.
Drunk people, yeah. Well, cheese, but we have plenty of cheese makers. Beer, okay. So I looked at malting and I looked at, you know, these other things. I looked at hops. And as I got deeper into hops education, Wisconsin was one of the largest producers of hops in the 1860s through just under the turn of the century. Okay, so great, they'll grow here, but you wouldn't believe how many times you can't grow hops in Wisconsin. Really? Little book for you to read, but that's how it started. And so we said, we came up with this program called the Charter Grower Program, where growers would get invested in their own production. We didn't own anything on their property. We were there as a technical support. We were there as the broker, basically, on their behalf, but we were going to build a brand behind it, Gorse Valley Hops. And we were going to do things differently in order to differentiate ourselves in the marketplace. And that's where all of my aroma science and chemistry and whatnot came in, with drying temperature and looking at the components that brewers want and where can we be different than the market is now, than the large scale hop growers. And you look at it and you say, well, why are you drying with high heat? Well, because that's how you do it. No, that's a way to do it. But you're blowing off X, Y, and Z volatiles. So why are you doing it that way? And, you know, being told for years and years that we can't do that. So we said baloney. So, you know, as part of this whole thing, I got Greg involved and Joe, my chemistry buddy, and Dan, our drying guy, you know, all these people that had the technical expertise that I thought we were going to need to address these hurdles. And we really pounded on the technical side. We really dug deep into the agroeconomics of what we were doing and started to build a brand that way and leveraged our technical acumen to interface with brewers to say, you know, we're adding value. Now, we're not just not selling you hops. I can also probably tell you how to fix your beer. Mm-hmm. And that added value, it got to the point, we built the company up enough. We had a branded drying technology called AromaSmart, which, by the way, Greg, did you see my email from Nebraska?
I did. Yes. Validation. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. The University of Nebraska, Lincoln, repeated our experiment validated all of our data.
That's excellent.
I'm like, It works. Stop calling low temperature drying 135 degrees Fahrenheit, Dick. Anyway, so that's how it started. And we got to the point where I think at our largest, we had 120 acres in production, both our own, because we were finding we couldn't get, people were all interested in hops, but they weren't interested in doing the work around what was going to be required to make quality. And we were finding that we were making more inroads with brewers than we could supply. And in order to have any kind of degree of confidence in our supply, we had to start growing ourselves. So we did, and we started small, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And then pretty soon we had 65 acre farm parcel of our own. And when most of our growers were 1 and 2 acres. So we learned a hard lesson there. But we discovered that if we were going to continue to do this, we needed to take a pretty hard left turn, pivot, as we always talk about, and either go into it significantly, which frankly, we were relatively debt-free at the time. So, or we need to do something else. And I didn't have it in me anymore to pivot and take that much more risk and that much more of my life away from, you know, my loved ones and my friends, and no, I'm done. So let's take the best parts of what we are doing and let's focus on that. And Hopnology was born. So education, research, consulting, complaining about stuff. So that's, there you go. That's the background.
Yeah, excellent. So I know I had this as I was writing these questions the other day. Something that I've run into, and I believe I mentioned this, being in the malt world, I spent a considerable amount of time speaking with barley growers and maltsters in places like upstate New York. So kind of the same thing, mm-hmm. where, you know, people, when the craft malt movement started, there were a lot of people who said, you can't grow barley here. Barley's grown in Colorado and Montana and Idaho. You don't grow barley here. You don't grow barley in the Southwest or Southeast. Mm-hmm. And now barley's being grown everywhere. But one of the issues in a state like, say, New York that has farm brewery laws, wherein the, you know, the brewers have to use, I think now it's, if you have a farm brewery license, you have to use up to 80% of local yep. ingredients. And one of the things I learned in talking with growers, specifically growers who did barley and hops, is that they didn't ever, they were fine in terms of always being able to supply the demand for malt because they could grow barley. There were enough barley growers in the state who could make that happen. But one of the challenges that they experienced was with hops, specifically, you know, the hops that you can grow in upstate New York are not typically the kinds of hops that brewers are wanting to buy right now, right? They're wanting those juicy, you know, a lot of proprietary brands that only a handful of people really own those brands and or yep. own those varieties and can supply those. So they could grow hops, but whether people would buy them would be a different story. So all of that is just a very long preface of me asking in terms of hop innovations. If I'm interested in getting into growing hops, how accessible are hop innovations to small scale growers?
Little to none.
Okay. So follow up question.
Frankly.
Also, like, yeah. So then what would be the incentive?
Right. So there's a, the reason I say that is if we use your preface of variety, breeding specifically, mm-hmm. proprietary breeding, just on the back of the envelope numbers, we do the calculations to bring any given variety to market that's, let's say, successful, is 10 years and $1 million. Mm-hmm. Easy. There's gobs and gobs of research being done on looking at genetic markers to do some quick pass-through screening to figure out, yeah, right. this one will produce the varieties we want. It takes a long time. And so these people that have that like the hop breeding group and folks that and Select Botanicals that are doing a lot of these breedings have literally millions of dollars wrapped up in these varieties. And so and some of them are my acquaintances. I'm never really bashing people on making back their investment in their IP. But for small scale growers, you know, one of the things they look at, one of the first things they look at when they encounter, this market narrowing of focus, brewer market, you know, narrowed focus of these proprietary smash mouth, easy button hops is I need to do that too, to compete. And I know that is absolutely the wrong approach to take because you can't. Mm-hmm. It would be akin to winning the lottery a dozen times over if you found one. And then how could you, even at your tiny, tiny scale, put the hundreds of thousands of dollars behind your marketing campaign in order to get it out there? It's just not going to happen.
Right.
So what are you going to do, right? That's your follow-up. We can segue this into Greg, into our local question about what does that mean? Because sure. that is a huge topic on our forum, one that I'm very passionate about. What does that local mean and what value does it have? But also, how does one position themselves to make enough of a splash to stay economically viable? So for small scale growers, it's relationship building, number one. Mm-hmm.
Hey everyone, it's Greg here, and this conversation just kept on going, so we decided to split it into two episodes. You can catch part two next week.
It's like the crossover episode between Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley.
It is.